This past April, over 200 people attended a civil protest at an Ohio Livestock Care Standards Board meeting in Reynoldsburg, Ohio. Due to the recommendations of these people and many others, the board reversed a previous proposal. The result was the establishment of a requirement for veal production stalls to be built large enough for calves to turn around. Shane Lampman was one of the many people that spoke in support of the calves during the public listening session.
We may think they're only animals, but they don't have the luxury of thinking that way. They are stuck in their own consciousness, and within that consciousness, they are clearly having a very real experience of suffering, a suffering that they are unable to rationalize away as the mere suffering of an animal. It is common to confine animals to living conditions that we would never accept for ourselves because we understand that they have a less complex consciousness, a smaller intellect than we possess. But in fact, this probably makes the experience far worse for them, because they are stuck in the moment. Animals are far more sensitive to their surrounding environment than we are. They cannot let their minds wander to find comfort in things like religion, philosophy, spirituality, or even hope. They cannot strive to find a purpose for their suffering, or accept it as part of God's plan, or think back to better times, or hope for a better future. They cannot reflect upon the suffering of others or find a reason to be grateful for their own blessings. All the methods we use to cope with our own suffering are unavailable to these animals. So they must sit and suffer and believe that they will always suffer unless someone chooses to understand their suffering and alleviate their anguish.
Our second reading is from Mary Oliver, many of you recognize as a UU, and this reading is from Some Questions You Might Ask from New and Selected Poems, Volume 1.
Some questions you might ask. Is the soul solid like iron? Or is it tender and breakable, like the wings of a moth in the beak of the owl? Who has it and who doesn't? I keep looking around me. The face of the moose is as sad as the face of Jesus. The swan opens her white wings slowly. In the fall, the black bear carries leaves into the darkness. One question leads to another. Does it have a shape, like an iceberg, like the eye of the hummingbird? Does it have one lung, like the snake and the scallop? Why should I have it, and not the anteater who loves her children? Why should I have it, and not the camel? Come to think of it, what about the maple trees? What about the blue iris? What about all the little stones sitting alone in the moonlight? What about roses and lemons and their shining leaves? What about the grass?
Some of you, no doubt, have fond memories of the places that animals have played in your lives. Perhaps it was a particular animal that came into your life as a child or an adult. Maybe a new puppy or a new kitten, or maybe it was a farm animal. Sometimes these animals were given to you by your family, or they came by your choice, or sometimes it seems as if the animal just chose you. I recall how our first cat became part of the family that my husband and I had just established. We had just moved to Columbia, South Carolina in 1972, at the start of our marriage, because Joe had been assigned to the Army post at Fort Jackson. One day, a tiny, skinny, black Siamese-looking kitten wandered to our front door. Now, this was a few years before we realized that my husband was allergic to cats. But didn't know that then, so I immediately adopted him, and we named him Elliot, after Elliot Gould, as I remember. And remember, this is 1972. Then about a year later, Joe brought home another cat, this one from the Army post, during a rare snowstorm in Columbia, fearing that it would not survive the cold, or maybe because he knew he couldn't come home and tell me about it and not bring it. This one received the name of China after the Grateful Dead song China Cat Sunshine. Okay, 73. My memories of how these two cats wormed their way into my heart is intertwined with the first years of our marriage as we figured out how together to become Mr. and Mrs. in the world. I still recall how Elliot would pick up food with his paws on occasion to feed himself, particularly for some reason, my homemade bread. I suspect that others of you remember very clearly the day a pet came into your life, or maybe the sad day that an animal left your family or left the world. Pets can add immeasurably to our lives. Yet to restrict our consideration of the animal kingdom to such personal remembrances is, of course, to do a great injustice to the very complicated relationship that humans have with world creatures. Appreciating animals for their own sake can be an awe-inspiring experience. Watching a pod of dolphins once, tears unexpectedly came to my eyes as I was moved by what I saw as their freedom to just be dolphins. However, our inability at times to be able to perceive an animal intrinsically on its own terms rather than through our own needs and desires can be very problematic. I think in small part this has stemmed from a reading of Genesis chapter 1, verse 26 from the Hebrew Bible. Earlier verses tell of the creation of moving creatures of the waters, fowl that fly far above the earth in the open firmaments of heaven, and every creature that moveth, including cattle and creeping things and beasts of the earth. Verse 26 then tells us, "And God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the seas, and over the fowl of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creepeth over the earth." We humans would do well to honor the seventh Unitarian Universalist principle, respect for the interdependence web of all existence of which we are a part, by embracing a relationship of stewardship with the creatures of the world rather than dominion over them. In giving animals a human assigned place, to use the words of Michael J. Rosen, we do serious damage to the creatures of the earth, as well as reducing our own humanness. Animals have been unnaturally displaced in the world, in their world. Rosen points out the complexity of our storytelling about animals when he talks about the comfortable distance we often require or desire between animals and our tolerance or appreciation of them. We oftentimes eat meat or wear leather clothes without considering the consequences of our action on the animals whose very bodies benefit us. Bill McKibben, in his book, The Age of Missing Information, warns us that something insidious happens when you get most of your nature through television. The real nature around you, even when it's intact, begins to seem dull, thus serving to distance ourselves from it. And zoos are another cause for reflection. Although they can open up a world of sight and sound and presence to us of the world's creatures that would otherwise be cut off from us, our appreciation of these creatures comes at the animal's expense. As John Berger describes it in his book About Looking, animals in zoos have been immunized to encounter because nothing can any more occupy a central place in their intention. You are looking at something that has been rendered absolutely marginal, and all of the concentration you can muster will never be enough to centralize it. And yet this issue is certainly complicated by the preservation of zoos that we do offer some animals. Preservation that zoos offer some animals. We are incurably ambivalent about most animals, Rosen points out, about their places in our society and in the unsocialized world, and about our role, caretaker, harvester, and warden, as we negotiate on their behalf as well, our needs with theirs, in abiding their presence, controlling their numbers, appropriating their territory. Our two readings call us to consider the spiritual nature of the world's creatures, in my way of seeing it. Shane Lampman offers us a disquieting question to consider. What is our role in alleviating the anguish of animals whose lives are taken for our benefit? And Mary Oliver's exquisite poem asks us to look at our own connection to creatures in a spiritual way. What do we share in common with animals? Why should I have a soul and not the anteater who loves her children? And now, members of the Unitarian Universalist Animal Ministry of this congregation will address some of the problems and joys this morning of human beings' relationship with animals. I would first like to call Rick Kreitzer forward.
Thank you. Good morning. When I was 5, I saved my allowance and bought my first of many guinea pigs. I liked petting them and listening to their squeaks and squeals. When I was 9, I picked blackberries for my mother to make pie. Nothing like homemade pie with fresh berries. Box turtles slowly chomped and fed on blackberries where I picked them. I collected the box turtles to see what they wanted to eat, in addition to blackberries. And I watched and marveled at how they acted, how they moved, and I tried to guess how they viewed the world. 17 years ago, my wife and I stopped eating poultry and mammals to reduce the animal fat in our diets. Then we realized that we respect animals and don't want to be part of their slaughter. Later, we learned of the environmental destruction caused by raising animals for food. To me, these are moral issues. For example, many cattle raised for beef use public land at no cost or little cost to ranchers. The cows erode the land and foul waterways. Then after a life of relative freedom, cattle are crammed into trucks and taken to slaughter. No doubt you've seen them on the road. Did you know they can be confined for up to 36 hours without food or water or a place to lie down? And who's keeping track of the time for all these trucks? After learning about the horrible conditions that egg-laying chickens are subjected to and the cruel abuse they suffer, I stopped eating eggs. When humans hunt sea animals, they're usually targeting a specific creature. Dolphins often swim above tuna, so fishing operations look for dolphins to help them find the tuna, and the tunas drown in the dolphins drown in the tuna nets. The Galapagos National Park personnel caught a tuna boat inside park boundaries, which is illegal in and of itself. It had over 50 dead and dying dolphins and just 8 tuna. So 8 tuna for 50 dolphins. Dolphins are considered bycatch. Bycatch refers to sea animals that are caught but aren't profitable. These animals like dolphins, juvenile fish, sea turtles, and seabirds. A specific example is shrimp, and who doesn't like shrimp? Yet for every pound of shrimp, 50 pound or 5 pounds of bycatch is thrown away, including 150,000 endangered sea turtles a year. I've stopped eating sea animals. To me, these are moral issues, and our response to these issues reflects poorly on humans and humanity. We have choices about what we eat. Our choices define our character and who we are. Here in Franklin County, there's 5,000 dogs euthanized every year. And during this time, people are buying designer dogs. Of these 5,000 a year, that's about 100 a week, 14 every day, including today. Some of you may recognize the name Barbara Kingsolver. She's the author of The Bean Trees and the Poisonwood Bible. In an essay about her daughter's chickens, she says, quote, "It's savings that compel me most to a vegetable-based diet. A pound of hog or cow flesh cost about 10 pounds of plant matter to produce. So grain that would feed 100 people is instead fed to cows or pigs that are then fed to people. This fills the bellies of only 10 people. The other 90, I guess, will just have to go hungry. That, in a nutshell, is how it's presently shaking down with the world's arable land, and the world's hamburger eaters." So I have a challenge for many who are involved in social justice and many who profess to care about the poor and the hungry. Why don't you help by changing your own behavior, your own eating? Change yourselves before you seek to change others. In his book, The World Peace Diet, UU Will Tuttle asserts that the typical American diet could feed 15 people based on plant-based, if they were using plant-based diets. His theme is that we will never have peace among humans until we stop killing animals. I really recommend this book. It's one of the most comprehensive and in-depth writings. All his everything that he says is documented. There's a copy of it back on the table, and I'd invite you to take a look at it and see the scope of what he covers. Will Tuttle was the pianist at Mark's former church in Hayward, California. I forgot to say that before. Tolstoy wrote that as long as we have slaughterhouses, we will have battlefields. Over 2,000 years ago, Pythagoras of the Pythagorean theorem said, quote, "As long as men massacre animals, they will kill each other. Indeed, he who sows the seeds of murder and pain cannot reap joy and love." Albert Schweitzer said, "By having reverence for life, we enter into a spiritual relation with the world." I think I have this reverence, and I do feel a spiritual relation with our world. People curse and swat the lowly housefly. And me, I don't really like them either. They're annoying. Yet, in recognition, in their scale, the fly can turn quicker than a fighter jet, can withstand more G-forces than a human, and they can land upside down. I think they deserve a little respect. The most astounding example to me is the monarch butterfly. If you don't know, they migrate from central Mexico up to North California every year. They then give birth to the next generation. In autumn, this generation goes south and finds the same place that their parents came from. Now, this information is transmitted genetically. They don't have GPSs, maps, or compasses. They don't have anyone to show them the way, yet somehow that information gets passed down to go from one continent to the other. So we think we're so superior, but insects have done things we can't do with centuries of study, science, and technology. Our seventh principle, covenants to affirm and promote a respect for the interdependent web of all existence, of which we're a part. I'd like to exist of which we are just a part. We're just a strand of that web. 3 years ago, in 2008, the National UU Animal Ministry started work on a statement of conscience that they hope would be adopted at the GA in 2011 or 2012. This draft was presented at this year's GA in Charlotte and was passed on June 24th. Among other things, the statement of conscience calls for individuals to increase consumption of plant-based foods for our own health, to provide more food for others, and to prevent harming animals, to advocate for legislation that realigns subsidies to support fruits, plants, and grains rather than just meat and dairy products. Congregationally, the statement of conscience calls on us to offer more plant-based foods at congregational events, provide educational programs for all ages that address environmental justice, gardening, food preparation, and nutrition, and include ethical eating in the multi-generational programming. The statement of conscience closes as following: with gratitude and reverence for all life, we savor food, mindful of all that has contributed to it. We commit ourselves to a more equitable sharing of the Earth's bounty. Thank you for your attention, and I now invite Lisa Darris to the podium.
Hi, I'm Lisa Darris, and like Kathleen and Rick, I'm going to start off with a personal story about an animal. A few weeks ago, I had an opportunity to have a wonderful canoe trip, and when all the canoeists came back to the shore, we gathered together for a photo opportunity. Someone had a camera, and as if on cue, a festival of fur plunged into our group. Atticus ran up to each of us as if he were thanking us for giving him the world just a few minutes ago. "Have you seen how wonderful my world is?" the newness in his eyes seemed to say. He looked like an adult golden retriever, but his wiggly, bouncing body gave him away as purebred puppy. I had just shared the wonderful experience of channeling the life of a loon on Little Hosmer Pond in northern Vermont with 12 attendees of a writing retreat. Over the past 3 days, we had shared pieces of our personal lives with one another through conversation, writing, and our common struggles to make sense of the environmental landscape which we were living in. Within 10 seconds, this little golden retriever puppy, Atticus, transcended any bond that we had developed simply by being a puppy. Upon his arrival, all of our body languages began mimicking his. Our voices changed. "You're a goddy, 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 goddy. I love goddy, 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 goddies." That's what you heard from us. As his owner led him down the path into the pond, I stood in awe of his wild abandon once he hit the water, turning himself inside out and upside down so his skin could soak up the coolness of the water on this hot summer day. Our camera never had a prayer for capturing his energy, but boy, if it could, photographers around the world would have been lining up to buy it. So for a large part of my life, I have really departmentalized animals and humans in a way that probably did neither species justice. People were just faces in the crowd. And animals were mysterious beings that embodied my innate quest to know more about how they think, what they think, and do they even think. The blood that dripped out of my finger after being bit by an opossum at the Wildlife Rehab Center, where I volunteered, reminded me, however, of our similarities. This possum's blood had stained my skin from the towel that had wrapped her ravaged body only a few hours before. Both dried into a sticky, wet darkness after being on my skin for a few moments. The 6 tiny offspring in her pouch that survived were dependent on this flow of blood and other life-giving fluids from their mother, just as they were dependent on me to administer the medications that would save their mother's life. I celebrated this biting incident, perhaps not just because it signified the wonderful wildness returning to her physical state, but because of how the mixing of my blood with hers reminded me that we were not so different from one another. In 1950, Temple Grandin, co-author of Animals in Translation, was labeled as autistic at a time when having this label meant blaming the mother, institutionalizing the child, and administering heavy sedatives for both. Due to early intervention initiated by her mother, Temple escaped this death sentence and worked for the next 30 years as an animal scientist and consultant in the livestock industry to bring about more humane conditions. Her writing focuses on the parallels between the way animals and people with autism experience pain, fear, memory, and socialization. Temple theorizes that in many ways, the brain of a person with autism operates similarly to that of an animal's. She explains that animals, like people with autism, can't see the forest for the trees due to their hypersensitivity of the details. To put it another way, humans without autism have large frontal lobes in our brains. These frontal lobes are most affected by injury and aging. When they're injured, that can often result in mental retardation. Grandin states in her book, "The price human beings pay for such big, fat frontal lobes is that normal people become oblivious in a way that animals and autistic people don't. Normal people stop seeing the details that make up the big picture and see only the big picture instead." As an outgoing introvert, I have become more aware of my ever-filtering frontal lobes after reading these theories. These lobes have kicked into high gear many times, especially when I'm surveying a crowded room that I'm about to walk into, or even right now as I'm up here speaking to all of you. They allow me to see things en masse and not become overwhelmed with all the details. The downside to this is that it becomes a habit, and often I only view things en masse and I miss a lot of details. I think that perhaps the reason I prefer to have animals in my life as a constant is because the animals minimize the filtering that these frontal lobes do. The animals sort of become my own personal high-def television to the world. They make me slow down and watch the details. And watching the details allows me to see the mystery and the wonder of life and this world unfold. As I have journeyed through years of relationships with animals, the question of value has been an ever-changing variable. In a Sand County Almanac, Aldo Leopold writes, "Our ability to perceive quality in nature begins as an art with the pretty. It expands through successive stages of the beautiful to values as yet uncaptured by language." End of quote. Many people never get past this prettiness of nature in order to place value on living things. Many of my friends assume that purebreds, or animals that are considered to be high producers in a farming environment, have a much higher value than those that don't fall into these categories. I have other friends who don't value the lives of animals that treat their gardens and flowers as a salad bar. These animals, unfortunately, are labeled as pests or nuisance animals in Ohio, and because of this labeling, the Ohio Department of Natural Resources has ruled it illegal to save the lives of these animals when they are found injured, for example, hit by a car on the side of the road. Once upon a time, I too subscribed to these values. While I have made many strides in the past few years at placing values on animals for the animal's sake, it is very complicated. I do my best to subscribe to the quote from Alice Walker in the beginning of our order of service today. She says, "The animals of this world exist for their own reasons. They were not made for humans any more than black people were made for whites or women for men." Subscribing to this belief has caused me to make different choices for what I put on my kitchen table. This place where friends and family have shared laughter, tears, surprises, good news, bad news over the years has become sacred to me. About 3 years ago, I became a member of a herd share program. I made this choice so I could extend the sacredness of my kitchen table to other species and allow them to live their lives in the best way possible so that I may benefit from the nutrition that they provide to me. My herdshare membership provides several gallons of raw milk to me each month, but more importantly, it provides several cows the dignity to live in a pasture in the sunshine or the rain, eating grass, much as a cow would in its natural state. Once I began to deliberatively apply a different value system to animals, I found it easy to extend this to other living beings. But as I said before, it gets really complicated. Although I'm still waging war on garlic mustard every spring, I have let the dandelions in my yard grow. My purchase a few years ago of a wood-burning stove has made me rethink the value that I place on trees. My cursing of the ash borer beetle has grown a little quieter as I have adopted a more utilitarian view of the wood that the trees killed by the ash borer have given me. A while back, someone asked me why I was so concerned about animal rights when there were so many powerful human-oriented causes that needed support. The answer to that question has many layers to it. I know that I can't help but give to a cause whose recipients continue to give back to us, even as we continue to perform genocide on thousands upon thousands of their species each day. I know that if we could unlock the mystery of instinct and throw out the self-serving intelligence of the human species, many living things would have a much better chance of surviving, including us. I know that, like Aldo Leopold, when I hear the call of a bird, as he says, it's no mere bird. As he so eloquently wrote, it is a symbol of our untamable past, of that incredible sweep of millennia which underlies and conditions the daily affairs of birds and men. By bearing witness to the animals, I connect to a sense of deep time that resonates in my soul. So from the golden retriever puppies of the world, to the passenger pigeons, to the honeybees, to the cockroaches, to the polar bears, to the giant sloth, I am acutely aware that what counts in the end is what's left. And without animals, nothing will be. Now I'd like to ask Steve Molk to come up.
Good morning. I am Steve Molk. For my part of the sermon today, I will tell you how and why I became a vegetarian and an animal rights activist. Like most children in the United States today, I grew up eating meat. And unlike many of them, I never questioned the practice. When I was in college, some of my athletic friends gave up eating meat. Incidentally, I didn't see a decrease in their strength or stamina, and they were still faster than I was. After college, I became friends with many politically active people who had become vegetarians. When I asked them why, they explained their reasons and recommended a book called Animal Liberation by Peter Singer. I read the book, which details the two main areas of concern for most animal rights activists: factory farming and animal-based research. On the December 31st, after my graduation from college, I made a New Year's resolution to give up eating meat, including chicken and fish, and I have not broken that resolution since. Here's a list of reasons that I'm glad I'm a vegetarian. Number one, I contribute less to the suffering and killing of animals. I cannot claim that it is immoral for humans to kill other animals for food, since many other animals besides humans eat animal flesh. But humans are the only species that confines and inflicts suffering on its food animals. My Buddhist brother would say that I have accumulated much less karma during my years as a vegetarian than I otherwise would have. Second reason, I help extend the world's food supply. It's been documented that it requires around 10 pounds of vegetable protein to produce just 1 pound of animal protein. As some of my other speakers have noted, the extra 9 pounds of protein might help feed some of the world's hungry. Number three, I improve my own health. By not eating meat, I avoid much of the intake of saturated fats and cholesterol I would otherwise consume. Studies have shown that because I don't eat meat, I'm likely to live longer than a meat eater and less likely to develop cancer, heart disease, or digestive problems. Reason number four, I help alleviate environmental problems. As a non-beef eater, I can say that I don't contribute to the environmental mess of feedlots in places like Chicago and Kansas City. When I buy organic or free-range eggs, I avoid supporting inhumane egg farms like the one recently shut down in Croton, Ohio. To me, the animal experimentation issue is also important, and I'll just summarize my views. As UUs, we have given up the notion that people have dominion over animals. We claim to believe that animals are part of the interdependent web of all existence. But as a society, we continue testing medicines and consumer products on animals. I believe that medical testing on animals should be limited and justified, and consumer products testing should be stopped. A medical researcher, must be able to show there is likely to be a clear and important gain in knowledge to be allowed to use animals in research. The testing of consumer products is too often a redundant use of supposedly disposable lab animals to tell us what we already know. Drain cleaner or floor polish or paint thinner will destroy the rabbit's eyes or cause their deaths by ingestion. Some companies, bless their hearts, have already made the move to cruelty-free products, but this needs to be a universal practice. Thank you very much.